start on this discussion of differentiation, just reviewing the sort of wording and discussion that we had back in Wellington, the sorts of things that were covered here cover a little bit of the spectrum of Wellington. We said must be a clearly differentiated space with respect to its purpose, had reasonable support. Then the other ways of wording that were must satisfy needs that cannot be met by existing TLD. So that's getting much more around purpose as opposed to strength. Then we sort of noted it's easy to consider differentiation between recent new TLDs, e.g. jobs and travel, and between some of the generic ones such as com and biz that might be considered to be serving the same purpose. Then the other thing that didn't have a lot of support was no applicant should be allowed to propose a TLD that's either transliteration of an existing TLD or a lexical or semantic equivalent of an existing TLD. So these were some of the things that were discussed in Wellington, and the closest we got to agreement on text was essentially those words there. The public comment period then has shown, I guess, quite a bit of discussion around this, and on the registrar's list, for example, there was quite a bit of concern that this may be used in some anti-competitive way to restrict people from competing with TLDs as opposed to opening up the domain space. So I think registrars were certainly concerned from a competition point of view. I guess there's other comments about whether we should just be focusing on the string itself rather than its purpose and making sure that the string is differentiated. One of the things I did just to look at another example of differentiation was just considering some of the wording that's used around trademarks. I just pulled a few statements from some of the trademark websites. These first few ones came from the IPO concept. Here's a trademark provides protection to the owner of the mark by ensuring the right to use it to identify goods or services. It hinders the efforts of unfair competitors, such as counterfeiters, to use similar distinctive signs to market inferior products and services. Enables people with enterprise to produce services in the fairest possible conditions. So that's kind of the, you know, trademark objectives. It's interesting when they talk about kinds of trademarks that can be registered. It says, in addition to trademarks identifying the commercial source of goods or services, other categories of marks exist. Collective marks are owned by an association whose members use them to identify themselves with a level of quality and other requirements set by the association. So dot travel is probably similar to that, and it's essentially saying those that have dot travel have met this criteria of membership. They're a member of a travel association or something. So it's similar to that concept. And then it talks about certification marks, so the equivalent of this is probably dot pro. Certification marks are given for compliance with defined standards but are not confined to any membership. They may be granted to anyone who can certify that they meet certain standards. The reason I'm going through this is sort of established stuff that has been built up over probably 100 or more years. I'm sure Uta could tell us trademark law probably derives back into ancient history at some point. And they yes, over 100 years. Now, one of the things when they evaluate trademark applications is that the mark must distinguish it and, you know, shouldn't be able to be confused with something else. This is just some stuff I picked up from the Australian Trademark Registration Authority, which basically says if a trademark is not capable of distinguishing the good or service, it will be rejected. They can rely on court cases and precedent. However, one of the main criteria is whether other traders are likely, in the ordinary course of their business, to need to use the same or similar mark. Traders should not be granted a monopoly in words, expression or logos which other traders may legitimately need to use to describe their own goods or services. This is interesting in the sense that if you look at some of the recent TLDs, it is giving them a monopoly over that particular word. So you are granting them a right. And then if you then subsequently say, let's say we were dealing with sport, and say, okay, you now have the rights to .sport, and then you say, well, nobody now can register anything else to deal with sport if we're going to be that differentiated, then that probably means you have to have a much stricter process up front to decide who gets to run .sport, because you're basically getting an organisation monopoly to .sport, and you're saying, I can't have .football because it's too close to .sport.
You'd be saying that you can't have .athletic or the counterpart of it in...
Before we get into the detailed discussions, just talk about it more generally, that if you give a monopoly right to a particular word, and then you say that you can't have any other word that's anything like it, that's a much stronger requirement to... It can't be confusingly similar.
However, Yahoo, which is a phrase in cowboy language, is trademarked to Yahoo. Some words that are general cannot be trademarked is actually, I think there are several examples of where companies have been able to prove that they have
through use
established right in them.
And this is the important thing there, though, is that Yahoo will have trademarked only in certain categories
that
have already been established.
Yes.
Now, when Yahoo, the people we know and love well, decided to try to trademark Yahoo for use in cowboy equipment, they may find it a problem.
And the other thing that is covered is the use of geographic names. And maybe in terms of descriptors, and they're saying that if you have, for example, and as you know, what I see as an example of this too, because I remember having difficulty getting that trademark, but it says, although geographical names have the potential to be registrable, traders will generally not be able to obtain a monopoly on that name or region unless overwhelming evidence of the use is provided. So again, I guess in the kind of trademark area, if I just create some random string of characters, it's relatively easy for me to get the trademark. If I choose a trademark that's a word like orange or something like that, then you then have to, it's either got to be distinguishing. I think there's a word mark versus a graphic image, for example, and I imagine, is that right? Also something like orange would be a graphic image, it's not the actual word that's trademarked. The orange telecommunications.
Yeah. I'm feeling very uneasy about saying anything about geographical indications and the dividing line between trademark and geographical indications differs country by country.
Right, this is just a particular example, that's right. I'm not saying this is international law, this is just an extract from Australian law. But I guess the reason why I'm raising it is, again, if you're giving someone a monopoly over a particular name that others may want to use, then your criteria for them to have that name may need to be higher than if you're creating something that's a completely new word. And that seems to be the sense of what I look at when I'm looking at that trademark law.
Did you find in your research references to the fact that some countries restrict for instance, in China, you cannot get the rights to use the word China without permission of the government, and you must have a license that is countrywide, otherwise you're restricted to a provincial use of product. And did you find any...
I didn't do this research. I just was picking an example just to give things to think about. I'm not trying to claim I've done research on trademarks. In fact, this was done in 5 minutes today. There's the benefits of the internet. But the reason why I'm kind of just throwing some of these things up is I think when we look at, say, second level TLDs, you're looking at something like .com. If you have a particular word in .com at the second level, let's say it has sport.com, because so many variations of that can also be registered, I can have football.com, I can have athletics.com, I can have sporttoday.com, it's very open. There's not, therefore, the same issues around who gets to have sport.com. But if you have a very restrictive environment and you're saying, okay, we're going to limit the introduction of new TLDs to these 10 new TLDs, and then you're going to give one of those 10 new TLDs to someone, then I think you start moving more towards the scales requiring some sort of comparative evaluation process. So I think when we're looking at differentiation, we need to be thinking, what are our objectives? If it's a fairly open environment, and I can have most TLDs that I want, as long as they're not confusingly similar, then we're in the realm of where I think Brett is saying, okay, well, we don't want COM and COMM because they're confusingly similar, but it's okay to have com and biz and shop and retail and other things, because you know, we've opened the space up, you can have all these, and as long as you've got the technical capability to operate and you can have it, as long as I don't have shop with double T on the end or whatever. That's one space. Another space to say, we actually want to create these kind of market purpose-oriented TLDs, and we're saying, okay, we're going to create a TLD for the purpose of sport, a TLD for the purpose of religion or whatever it is, and then you're going to say, okay, now that I've created this TLD for sport, you know, you can't have it on football because it's too close to sport, it's just the purpose. That means if you're going to have that rule, then whoever gets to run .sport, you're probably going to need a much stronger, almost a comparative evaluation process to say, well, who out of all these people that want to do something in sport should operate sport. So just kind of putting that as a context for discussion.
Or, in that same context for discussion, there might be the question of, is the applicant broadly representative enough of the group that they say they're going to sponsor, which was a question we did ask ICANN to determine.
And that's, what I'm saying is that kind of issue becomes important when you're pretty much giving them an offer out of that area. And I think that's where some of the controversies happen, is when you have a generic word like a dot sport, and someone says, well, how can you get to run dot sport? I want to run dot sport.
But can I ask a question about the use of the term monopoly?
I've used given the consent. You've given a person exclusive rights over that word, and then your monopoly rights would extend by what how we're defining differentiation defines the scope of that monopoly, really. So if it's at the level where I think Brett was, say Brett specifically, but the views that you are encapsulating is essentially saying that it's a very narrow right. You get the right to have that stream. And other people can have other streams, as long as they're not confusingly similar. So it's a very narrow right, versus a very broad right, which is to say, you get dot sport, and you can have anything to do with the topic of sport is yours. That's a much broader right. And so what the reason I'm saying that is our wording of this differentiation is defining the level of that right, really, because you're limiting the ability of someone else to register a similar name, essentially. And it's a matter of how much you're limited by. Trademark law is essentially saying, I have this string of characters, if we're just dealing with words for a second. I have this string of characters. If I'm in the same area, so if I have Yahoo, for example, and it's for the purpose of internet, you probably wouldn't be able to register Yahoo with three O's if you're going to trade in the area of internet. If you're going to create a Yahoo shoe shop, and it did have three O's, it's probably fine, because they're not in the same category. So trademarks is really giving you a right on a string and also restricting other people from having similar strings to the same category, basically. So I think the concept of differentiation is really all about how much of a right are you giving the operator, once they've got it, in terms of protection on their string.
And so it's worth mentioning the concept of confusingly similar and asking Uta whether that is a concept that is a global concept versus a concept that is unique to the developed world, because there is a concept, and companies like AT&T, for instance, also have service marks that they protect, and there is a concept of confusingly similar and misleading in U.S. law that I don't intend to speak to any other law, but I wondered if it was a concept that is recognized in other countries.
goods recognized in other countries, but I think we would probably need to look at international trademark agreements to get something like an international standard. And I might have missed the way how we got into this discussion. Can I just confirm that this is not the only test that would apply, and that we're not just going to look at parallels between trademark law and...
No. I'm just using that as something that is an environment where you've given someone a right and then it's got certain protections. You don't allow someone else to register something that's easily the same.
We're just looking at trademark law as giving us guidance to what has been established in other areas in order to avoid consumer confusion.
Now, I'm trying to use it as a way of saying that we need to be clearer in what our policy is, because I don't think we are clear at the moment as to what right we're giving the operator once they've got it. In terms of if I've got an existing TLD and then there's an application for a new TLD, what protection does that existing holder have? This is the session I'm talking about.
Bruce, I think you're right to have separated some of the concepts there, and that's been a useful foundation. Maybe as a proposal to start, where probably we would all have agreement, will be to make a statement that TLDs should not be confusingly similar to other TLDs. I mean,
you make it confusingly similar with respect to
the screen.
Yes, that's why I want to
come back. That's something probably where I'm not seeing any disagreement. I'm not seeing anybody who says, yeah, confusion is great in the marketplace, even among the comments.
So let's just go down this line a little bit.
Bruce, while you're doing that, can I just ask another clarifying question? So there's been a distinction made between the differentiation between the string, ABC versus ACB, confusingly similar, and the purpose. And you're only talking about the string.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So that the string, the TLD string should not be, what's the word you used? To an existing TLD string. So, and there's an element of subjective stuff that's going here, but e.g. .com would be considered confusingly similar to .com.
Yeah,
how is that?
No.
Well, that's another issue.
But that's the thing, is contesting that thing.
But before we ruin our principle on examples...
Yes. no, but this is the thing we want to test by example,
yeah. So you may want to look at this wording, which was originally from working group B, for those of people with long memories, agreed between the non-commercial and the business constituency at the time.
I'll just put that up on the screen, so a new... Because it's a derived word,
certainly. I thought Tom's commercial, not Tom's.
Comes with a fresh.
So that's the wording that was, what's it called?
which then, I mean, this is a discussion
with the capital farmers and myself on the board of the UTM on scratch and technology. So the UTLE proposal should avoid names that have the potential to confuse net users because they are typographically similar to variants of or derived words from existing GTLDs. Equally, confusion with popular marketing terminology or brand names should be avoided unless a bona fide rationale for the similarity and a means to address confusion were apparent. That last sentence I think is probably important. It's just kind of where, when you look at the trademark stuff, at least just using the Australian example, is at face value a lot of things get rejected. But if for example, .com meant something for a specific community, and you had mechanisms in place that only members of that community could get COWM, that's probably fine. But if you were creating COM for the purpose of competing with .com, and if it was completely open, then it would not be.
You don't need to have a huge list of examples and tests necessarily in place in order to, once you agree that as a principle, you simply have that as part of known smart application process,
yeah.
And hopefully you put off stupid applications that would be caught by that.
But it's useful, though, just for the purposes of clarity, because I'm particularly looking at the song in the public comment that we do use some examples here.
Yeah.
So, let me just go through some of these examples for a second. So, .com would be considered confusingly similar to .com. What about .com? What are you saying there? Are you, under your definition, Tom? I agree to reverse derivation. What you're saying is if you had .com, you wouldn't be able to have .com.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if there ought to be a challenge process that you apply, an incumbent can say, I challenge that, and then... Then there's lawsuits. I don't know, something similar to like the .biz stop process or one of these, some UDRP-like thing, so that we don't decide it now, but we sort of come up with criteria.
I think that because you're using the term commerce, that's quite an English, I mean that term isn't widely used around the world, I don't think. E-commerce probably is,
Can I just ask a point of clarification?
Well, let's use that one. That's probably a better one than that. What about e-commerce? Would that be okay? But someone could have e-commerce as well as .com, because you couldn't really say they could be using this.
And could they have that e-com?
Mm. Well, that's the hardest.
Yeah.
I think they could.
They
should be able to.
So I should be able to have dot e-commerce,
which there's a Q in there, already.
But you should be able to have dot e-commerce, definitely
can't. A Q? Yeah, orderly.
Yeah. I'm happy to have this little bit free time at the moment. I'm just trying to get
I just wanted to offer a couple of points. One, the registry consistency did discuss this point exactly what Brett just said. I want to get that in, which is our opinion is to consider the creation of a dispute resolution process whereby existing and potential registry operators or sponsors could challenge a decision regarding whether or not a new GTLD is clearly differentiated from the existing or proposed GTLD. And the theme of this is to place the burden on an existing registry operator through some mechanism to contest. So that's where the burden lies. One other point of reference I want to make.
Take that through. So what does that mean? So you, and maybe those who understand the trademark concept, you've got a body with a trademark thing, you're applying for a trademark, someone can contest that, that means that body could say yes or no. And then I guess ultimately then it can go to the court. Is that right, Brett? And also that probably...
But what happens with trademark process where it's taken all the way through. So someone tries to trademark, someone objects to that, the body is going to make a decision based on its interpretation. And then the recourse is then on the court, isn't it? And then who are you serving? The other party or the body that's made that decision?
Well, as I was envisioning it, there would be a publication date so that you publish the application, iwant.ecom.
Yeah.
Then there would be a set period whereby any, I guess, existing incumbent, or perhaps even you want to smoke it out and then let it be broader than that, could, you know, 10 days, 20 days, 30 days, object to it, state the reason for their objection, and then it would go to a panel that would make its determination. I don't know. And I don't know whether that's an independent panel or a board or the board or the GNSO. I mean, I think we need to, if we're going to go down that path, I don't want to leave it open-ended. I think we ought to specify it.
Yeah. But what's the legal recourse after that? In the trademark process? Because in the trademark process, also you're applying to a trademark body, that's Australia, and that trademark body, then you can object to a new trademark. Let's say the trademark body overrules your objection and says, yes, we're going to accept it anyway. What is then the mechanism? Is it then, are you then taking it to court under trademark law?
Country by country, but in most countries, I would think, a trademark is put forward for registration, somebody objects, and then a decision is being made. And if that decision is then taken to the court, obviously it would go to the court system. That court would look at procedural questions or broad brush issues, but it would not review the decision itself on merits because the court wouldn't necessarily be competent to do that. So the court would look at whether the board has applied the rules in the right way, but not look at...
But you are often in the process that's allowed to present evidence of use. Like, for instance, if you're asserting that you have established use, then you have to build a record in detail yourself, right?
Yes.
But I question whether the rules of trademark law that are national, regional, and international...
No, I'm just trying to understand how the disputes are handled. Because obviously you might not agree with the decision, so... You know.
One thing that makes me feel uncomfortable is that obviously... And the trademark law, it is usually the trademark holder who can object to somebody else using their trademark or seeking registration of it. Whereas I think the consideration that the interest that we have in mind are not necessarily only vested with the registration.
So that's a slightly broader comment than what I check.
Thank you, Kirk. The question I have for Brad is, at what point in time do you think that the process should be used, actually, at the time that the domain name is already awarded to a company, or at the time of the application process, or, I mean, there are various stages where you can launch such a process. One would be to do it right up front. So if you open up the application phase and the applications are published, before even there's any kind of evaluation, at that point of time, we should have such a process. It would be very cost efficient. So that no one is putting money into anything where he doesn't have a chance because he's disputed right away.
So one of the things, because you're talking about a process, I think what Audu was saying is there's some public process, and so anyone can say, yep, I don't think it should have that stream. So then what would be the basis of that? Is it just this, or is it you're complaining because I want that stream instead? Because it's a slightly different thing. I mean, I can see, in other words, if Ray's saying someone wants to stop jobs spelled like this, JOBBS, now, Ray may or may not complain about it. I can complain about it. Is that what you're saying? I can say, I am a holder of a .jobs domain name. I don't know. Someone else, I think that's the main
answer. Let me give a real life example. That's kind of a typo example, right?
Yes.
Okay, so that's kind of its own kind of commonsensical.
Yes.
Now, a real life example might be the dot jobs application in 2004, where the evaluation team came back and said, well, you know, you're encompassing labor, you're encompassing unions, you're encompassing other things when you say jobs.
Yes.
And our response to that was, there's nothing stopping unions from filing for dot union. There's nothing stopping labor from filing for dot labor. So while those might be terms like com and commerce, or they might be looked upon, you know, getting a lot of user subjectivity, the real answer to that question is that if somebody wants to file for dot labor, they can file for dot labor. If they want to file for dot union, they can. You know, there is no monopoly. For example, we can take the position we own the whole.
So you can say the dot labor is not confusing with Schindler's dot job. So that's right.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Purpose. If they describe their purpose and it's similar as what dot job is doing.
The view really of the registered constituency is to have as objective a criteria as possible. So we can what, if anything, up front, and that generally is what bleeds objective criteria into subjective criteria, because you're trying to what if everything away. So yeah, there's all kinds of what ifs, I think, but our position is that in order to get to an objective spot is to remove the subjectivity. And there's nothing wrong with the jobs and the labor in the market.
Yeah. Can you just give me, because I want to capture this concept which you picked up and Brett picked up, which was the concept of an order as well, that there's a like a public comment process. What's the wording you had for that?
Consider the creation of a dispute resolution process whereby existing and potential registry operators or sponsors could challenge a decision regarding whether or not a new GTLD is clearly differentiated from...
Just like that, whether an existing or what
was that? Oh, consider the creation of a dispute resolution process whereby existing and potential registry operators or sponsors, got a lot of semantics going on, could challenge a decision regarding whether or not a new GTLD is clearly differentiated from other existing or proposed GTLDs.
The additional element that Order was adding there was the idea that it's not just the registry operators, but it could be registrants, presumably, or other members of the public. Is that right?
But I think that would be an interesting drawing the line somewhere, just to avoid that there's never going to be any new GTLD.
Yeah.
But affected parties...
This is not a power of veto, though. This is just, you'd have to have justification that...
That's a difference of interest, of course, but
certainly
it shouldn't include
random. The thing I'm saying there is, if I was, if I had Yahoo jobs, and someone was trying to create something that I thought was going to be extremely similar to that, Yahoo would complain because they had a registrant of Yahoo.jobs.
That's second level complaint. I was thinking more about the Department of Labor. I understand, but I was thinking more about labor. There are many governments who will think the term labor or employment is a, and I would think that you probably encountered this, Ray, where employment is typically the such and such government employment agency or Department of Labor, et cetera, where the word to the government agency probably is synonymous with job. And so labor or employment to them might be a word that means the same thing as job, no?
Yeah, that's a perspective. I think what partially what we're discussing here is fanciful terms versus generic terms, if you will. Jobs is a generic term. Google is a fanciful term. But
the essentially a defined word, by the way, but anyway. It's not typically used on those terms for a population of people.
But our point was just because we were filing for jobs did not mean someone else cannot file for labor. I mean, those are two generic terms. One was not fanciful and the other not fanciful. Both are generic. Employment is generic. Jobs is generic. So I don't, you know, towards getting to objective criteria, the more you go down the road of placing higher burdens on a generic term, the less objective the criteria is going to be.
So this is probably more of an implementation issue than a policy issue, but building on what Thomas said, why can't we have this discussion up front at the time we sign the contract with a new registry and hardwire the terms that are confusingly similar into the agreement? So into the agreement, there's 50 or so terms maybe that are confusingly similar.
That's actually another topic I want to get into, because is it okay for taking the frontier 1A, we're saying it's not okay for a competitor to have .com. Is it okay for VeriSign to have .com? That's, yeah, sure. I just give that example. But, yeah, because this is something that's, the reason why this is interesting to think about is in the IBM discussion, there's been discussion that a TLD operator may wish to have their string in the, in another character set that's appropriate for a different language, and which is fine. But the question is, do they have any extra rights over someone else? So taking, it really to me doesn't matter whether we're talking about COMM and .com or whether I'm talking about .com and Chinese characters. The question is, there's something to think about. Let's just put this in an example. If I had...
Maybe help us understand a bit more about the parallels we looked at in the trademark world.
Yeah.
In the trademark world, you have two reasons for refusal of a trademark. You have one which you call absolute grounds. It's a list of things, if you're not on the list, you don't get the trademark. Now that is an assessment done by the trademark authority. And the notion of confusingly similar is part of that. So that assessment is done. And that means confusingly similar is in European terms, described as a likelihood to confuse a member of the public because of the similarity that exists in the name there.
Just let me just put that one down for a second.
So a likelihood of confusion on the part of the public.
Now, that word's probably relatively easy for trademark because it's within a country.
That's actually regional law. I'm quoting the version from European law, so that's already 25 countries covered.
Okay, so what's the likelihood of confusion?
It's called the likelihood of confusion on the part of the public. But that phrasing is also typical in most international treaties of trademark law, etc. So it's not just European or countrywide. You then have...
just stop for a second. Can I just take a cue? So I've got Philip, Brent, anyone else? Okay.
So that's an absolute ground for refusal of a trademark. And the idea there, behind that, is the public interest. That we don't want the public to be confused and to allow fraud or whatever. Right? The second ground is called a relative ground, and that's the challenge procedure. It's an existing trademark. So once you've gone through a process of application, trademark authority says, that looks okay, and you know, you pass the first set of hurdles, and they then publish that to make it known that applications happen. Now, I'm a competitor of that application. I've got a trademark, which I think is pretty damn close to this application. And I can now make a challenge procedure based on, not confusingly similar, but based on harm to my reputation. And that's the difference. So it's where the trademark is identical with or similar to the trademark of the other guy, where the latter has a reputation for that thing. Okay, so what's your, so the challenge procedure is always then related to the reputation that I've established in the market and the potential harm may come with that. And that's a different concept for a challenge procedure as to a competitor saying something about this is a public good. So I think it's important to separate those two in terms of the way the trademark law wants to use, wants to use that as a parallel in our thinking here. Because I think it's much easier for us to agree that, you know, C0M is not a good idea. Whether or not .commerce is infringing the reputation of VeriSignOperation.com may be a better thing to assess by challenge procedure than it would be as a assessment of a panel set up by ADCAN.
Yeah. Now, is that partly too, Philip, that the person challenging may not necessarily have a trademark?
Yes. In trademark law, in order to make a challenge, you have to have a registered trademark.
Yeah. Have a registered trademark.
Yeah, you do that. Yeah. Or, yeah, you can have, well, put a common law trademark, but you have
to... I was wondering about the common law trademark issue, because you could
yeah.
Try through use.
Yeah, through use. Yeah, that would work as well.
Yeah.
I couldn't even hear that.
Do you say that you actually have to have trademark in order to challenge, or do you just have to have standing?
Essentially standing, because that you can't have acquired common in many jurisdictions, not all. You can acquire what are called common law rights by standing by the fact you've used that name over time, and that in some countries can be used on the same basis. It's all to do with the same concept, because the reputation that you've established in the market, either because you've got on a list or because you've been in the market for so many years.
Would a targeted group have standing? By that I mean, could one argue that I used this and am confused, in effect? Do you understand a community? I'll give you an example. Suppose you're an eBayer. Somebody... Would you have standing, and I'm wondering whether or not you'd have a right to challenge on the basis that the prospective name would be confusing to the community that is currently using it.
Well, another question I would have for you, Philip, and this is for Gratis. If I understand that correctly, that only, it only works for trademarks in a specific country, right? So you can only go after people which infringe your trademark or your standing in a specific country that you hold that trademark or have the standing. So for example, if a company is known for mail services in Europe somewhere, or all over Europe maybe, and they would kind of file a suit somewhere in the States for someone infringing, you know, making a business for mail services, would that work, or would that be totally unrelated?
In order to establish your standing to challenge application, you need to have a trademark in the country or in the European Union, the region as well, because you've got a European Union trademark these days. But getting that is doesn't necessarily mean you have to apply country by country. There are international treaties which allow you to fast track such applications. But you do have to have that already. That may be the difference here, because we're potentially talking about challenges by others who can be converted to
process.
And ironically, I think we're moving away from the very important point that you made, which was that there are actually grounds for refusal, irrespective of any challenge.
Yes.
So a trademark will be refused for registration and not be recognized by the court if it is confusingly similar, even if somebody holding a similar trademark does not step in and say, well, look, you know, my business interest is affected. And I think that's, and I'm not jumping with you, that's the point that I was making earlier, because I think the parties affected are often the registrants in a TAG space who will have to re-register under the new TAG that is confusingly similar, and that is the interest of my community, of my constituency that I have at heart. So, I think we need to even take it further than the rules of trademark law and extending to parties that do not have an interest in a similarly confusing combination of letters, but who are in some other way affected.
So what you're saying is that the owner of example XYZ may complain about the existence of XYZ because if someone registered the word example in that, those people can be referring to someone. So what you're saying is that this person here would have standing to complain about the owner of example.xyz could complain about the creation of xyz due to the potential of a third party registering example.xyz. So let's just kind of give an example of someone that
hey Bruce, is xyz a typo example? Is that meant to be a typo scenario?
It doesn't have to be, but I just chose that one to be that way.
Could that be jobs and labor?
Yeah, and I think you'd find that if that was the case, you'd probably not grant that request, I would say. Because example.labor is different to example.jobs.
Okay, if you could bring up another example, could you exchange labor through Arbeit? The German word for Arbeit? A-R-B-E-I-T?
Because the other dimensions here, so we've talked about misspellings, there's also language difference.
Right, and that's one of the things we haven't talked about at all.
That's exactly right.
That really gets us in the talking.
So what's the German for
troubles?
Is that right?
What's it?
I two.
Okay. Yeah. And what's your view on that, right? Dot jobs versus dot habit. Because that's a direct translation of the word jobs, is it? In other words, a direct language translation of the word jobs. What's the view? What's your personal view on that?
I think in this, I kind of go back to Kurt's point. I mean, which is at the time of registry contract negotiation, there could be a list then at that time provided of those that would be deemed as confusingly similar in the marketplace. This might be one of those. Whereas a translation of labor, obviously, into another language such as German, would not be the English version and not the German version, but jobs perhaps translated into any other language could fall into that group. But that would be where that would be under the contract negotiation.
Well, because one of the things, what you're talking about for the contract negotiations, what you're defining there is your rights. And so you're saying that I fight for dot jobs, but I also want the rights to be able to, let's say, to have dot RV as well. And that means that that's effectively the extent of your contract is dot jobs plus dot RV, whatever else is added on there. And maybe Chinese characters and other things. That might be okay
done, that might be okay going forward. How would you address the current situation? So would you then have the option as the, because one of the things I'm looking at here, you're an existing operator of jobs. You currently don't have that in your contract. You now want to have got RV.
Yeah, I think what the question you're asking, though, is a business decision on the part of each individual existing registry. If we're going to stick with that scenario where, you know, we're looking at a legacy situation, then that becomes a business decision on the part of each registry whether to contest that or not. And whether dot jobs would or not, I don't know. We'd have to look at that, the business aspect of that. My feeling is we wouldn't, and I don't know, it's just the assumption. But it would be a business decision by each operator. That would be my view on the legacy aspect of it.
Just one of the things that I should probably go around with the room with people's views, but these are just different dimensions. So I wanted to just start with the misspelling dimension because that's probably the easiest to initially think about. But there are other dimensions, which is language and character sets and other things as well, which, and the reason why these are really good examples, when you see the examples, you can think, is that what I meant by that particular policy? So let's just go in on the field here.
I think you've alluded to the session that we may have gotten at some of the
First of all, if we are talking about providing a contest period, I think the contest period, defining who gets to participate in the contest period is important, and I don't think we've explored it enough just yet. But secondly, I don't think, and I wasn't sure that I understood the point, the existing registry and what standing the existing registry has is actually not clear to me in contesting additional names.
Yeah, but the point I was trying to get there, Marilyn, is
with respect to the confusingly similar thing, let's just take the misspelling for a second. At the moment, at the second level, companies like Melbourne IT will deliberately actually register misspellings of its company name because it knows people mistype stuff on the keyboard. And it does that for a couple of reasons. One is protection, so someone else doesn't get it. But also, obviously, it's a convenience to the user, so that they don't have to...
I need to be clear about what I wasn't clear about. That is whether there'd be any kind of priority treatment of the present manager of a string versus the...
Well, it's just not a priority. Would there be different treatment?
Well, so my comment is that the challenge processes do need to be open and transparent and publicly available. So that would be one point that I would make. The second thing that I would say is there's an issue of substitutability. So Ray might not, as the operator, see labor as substitutable to jobs, but the registrant, based on their language and their experience in their country, might find a word substitutable. So a German translation of .jobs may be appealing to German job seekers or job providers, but not be recognizable to Chinese, while the Chinese equivalent, and I think this is a much more complicated discussion than we've had time to devote to it today.
I actually don't even think that there is any such thing like an equivalent. For example, Arbeit it's a translation that is pretty close if you want to pick a short word for jobs. Jobs is a very defined word in English to talk about employment opportunities, right? Arbeit is a generic term in German, which means just work, right? But what could be used as scripts for jobs as well, which would be the most proper thing to use probably. So it's not even a direct translation. I think we would be finding it harder to, make business decisions, what should be on that list and what should be not, especially if you have to consider 240 different languages, whatever, you know, with different scripts and stuff like that. That really makes it hard, you know. So I don't even know whether we can single certain cases out or not. You know, especially if you get into the IDNs, it'll be very hard to single things out. Right? If it's that sort of way, you know, you're not allowed to do it.
That's the difference between Kurt's responses and the fine list approach. It's basically saying you have certain rights over the set of strings, and that's it. It's defined in your contract. It's a defined list approach. I think Mabel's given the example between permissible versus restrictive or something. And the other approach is basically to say very generally, the strings should not be confusingly similar, and then you just simply have a dispute process. So in other words, you don't need to have those defined way. You can just say, I consider this to be a problem. Just two different approaches. From Kurt's point of view, it's easier to manage from my client's point of view because you look up the list, is it on there or not? But from your point of view, it's more difficult because you may not know in advance. You didn't know about the existence. I'm sure you didn't know about .rb. Now you do. You're thinking, oh, maybe I should have had that there.
In terms of priority, there's no guarantee we would win any kind of process like that if we did decide. And just to mail with one point, if jobs translated in German and people in Germany looked at it differently, and then the same thing in China and people looked at it differently, that to me seems like differentiation.
Okay, let's just keep looking through the queue, and then we'll perhaps just explore this from one of the things I think is whether we're converging on at least this text up here is okay, and we're having some definitions on that. That's focused on the string. This point E is a little different. This is a different point because it's not, is it confusingly similar at the string level? It's some other way confusing. And you know, some other element to it. So, this, where are we on the key?
No, I haven't come up
with that.
I wanted to react to two things in the conversation. The first one was, Bruce, you asked whether a incumbent registry could challenge someone else having a string and then later ask for it for itself. I think I felt fairly strongly in my reaction to that if you challenge something because it's confusingly similar, that you can't have it yourself. That it's either open for an ETLB or it's not. And it's not just that only VeriSign can operate a certain string. So that's my first point. I wanted to react sort of strongly against the statement you raised, I think just as a thought for us to consider.
You're proposing there's no differentiation. In other words, each operator has equal standing in the sense of applying for new string.
Right.
And then if you say it's confusingly similar, it's confusingly similar, so no one can have it.
That's right. You have not that you have a preference for it.
Yeah.
Right.
That would be the same kind of thing.
The second issue is I wonder whether if we do have a challenge process where there's publication and the opportunity to challenge things and invoke some sort of UDRP thing, if we open standing to that up to anyone in the world, which I swear I heard at least one variant of the conversation going, you know, I'm afraid that we're increasing the complexity and cost on applicants tremendously. Because I can pretty much guarantee you that if there's an application for, you know, .doodle, there's going to be some trademark owners saying that, you know, they wish that they didn't have to register in .doodle because, you know, they've already got a .com and it's going to be confusingly similar if someone else registers trademark .doodle. And I think we don't want to get into that. So I would.
Well,
I would.
Yeah, these constraints, isn't it? Because you have to have standing. Just like that as an example. Not everyone can use UDRP processes as standard name. If you have got a whole trademark in that area that's standing for the initial UDRP settlement.
It's sort of been expanded over the years from registered trademarks to trademark rights, and now you have people who have no trademarks but rights and publicity in their name. Filing UDRPs that are actually getting moved along. So we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm Tom Cruise, but I'm a trademark in Tom Cruise, but I want to go ahead and use the URD. And you see an evolution in sort of the thinking about how these things are applied.
So who would you find we should have seen?
The incumbent registries.
Right, so they're not applying it as they're right.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll leave it. It's a bit odd to say that, although I understand the attraction of a list as we heard the name would be similar, I think it's a terrible idea. But the following reasons, I mean, A, establishing cluster lists is already adding to the controversy and difficulty of application in terms of the extent of the monopoly rights that you're creating. And it seems to me to be unnecessary anyway to have a robust planning procedure which is based on the reputation or damaging the reputation of a party in seeing that same area of business. I think it's important, again, as I was saying earlier, to be clear about the difference between things that could be used per se and things that could be confusing about the business model. So the example of job J0 DS confusing similar to the process, but are by not confusing similar at all, but
It assumes that they have got a pre-evaluation, you know, which one of the suggestions we have that we can also
This might be one of the things, that's kind of the topic is where we're in the process of resolving before you get into the more detail there. But there was similar issues. If you say $250,000 to evaluate someone, and then in the end you say, no, I should say
that. What I'm looking for is a potential to design
Who had what for lunch?
So we could say that in the
thank you, Olaf Norman. Just a quick comment. Since it seems we're trying to define confusingly similar, I just wonder, is there a definition in the experience of the trademark law about what constitutes? Yeah. And does it go into confusing the similar meaning, confusing the similar in translations as well? Because I think that's where we were for a while at least. Meaning that, all right, you have a bit like the Kodak doctrine, where Kodak, you couldn't use that anywhere, because it has a specific meaning everywhere. But when you translate, like labor jobs into Arbeit, or in Swedish Arbete, or Rabota, in Czech, or something like that, would that constitute a confusing this similar situation? Is there any experience to draw from the trademark law there?
I think that might be the people have been considered confusing similar, but generally I would say not. But I think this is one of the many cases that show that we have to bear issues in mind that are not relevant under the trademark law.
So what I suggest we do is have another break for 10 minutes. Time's 20 minutes to 5. I'm conscious that many of you have travelled today and are probably reaching the end of your concentration span. But I'll try and just sort of, the next 10 minutes, just sort of summarise, I think, some of the points that seem to get reasonable support. And then just test it a little bit more with some more examples that go beyond the misspellings and just talk a little bit about language and then just think how it might work for IDNs as well and see if what we've stated is okay. I'm also just interested in testing whether we're okay with this being focused on the string, or at least that's one area of agreement, and is there something in addition to that that's required which might go beyond the string. I'm not sure whether that's there or not, whether there's a view on that. So let's just break for 10 minutes. I'll try and close off this discussion, focus on the string, and just explore that with some more examples, and then just consider whether we want to go beyond strings into other stuff, and maybe we'll talk about that more tomorrow morning. So I think we'll aim to finish at 5:30 today, if that seems reasonable, based on people's attention spans. What if we want to work longer? Yeah. Yeah, let's work on it. I'm just talking about how long people want to work on it.